We have kind of a tradition in the Schramm household. On Christmas Eve, the family gathers around the tree, and after church, we read stories to one another. And each year, we try to get a different Christmas story to add to our collection. So we've started collecting Christmas stories, and I'm going to share two of those with you today. Two of them are my favorites. And then I'm going to read just one paragraph from two books that are in the bookstore, so you'll get somewhat of the flavor of the book. And then I'm going to read one short poem from a book that we also have in the bookstore. So just so you can gear up, there's a short poem, two short paragraphs, and two stories that are a little bit longer. The first is from a booklet that we have in the bookstore by Douglas Steer, who is a Quaker, and it's called Bethlehem Revisited. It's a book. It's a sermon that he wrote, and it begins like this. Christmas is a time when we are invited to revisit Bethlehem and to reconsider its miracle. Bethlehem does not change, and the miracle does not change, but we change. And the eyes with which we are able to see change are also different. Hence, what we see from year to year is not the same, which makes this annual visit an adventure rather than a routine pilgrimage. I think this is very true, and the poem that I'm going to read later on speaks to it too. A very popular book at Holden is Martin Luther's Christmas book. I think probably many of the pastors have it. Martin Luther writes about the nativity, the visitation, the wise men coming, and two paragraphs from his section on the nativity goes like this. There are so many of you here who think to yourselves, oh, if I had only been there at the birth of Jesus, how quick I would have been to help the baby. I would have washed his linen. How happy I would have been to go with the shepherds to see the Lord lying in the manger. Well, yes, you would. You say that because you now know how great Christ is. But if you had been there at that time, you would have done no better than all the other people in Bethlehem. Childish and silly thoughts are these. Why don't you do it now? You have Christ in your neighbor. You ought to serve him. For what you do to your neighbor in need, you do to the Lord Christ himself. And later on in the book, in the same little section, he says, you know, what in the world did Mary and Joseph use for swaddling clothes? Mary must have taken her veil, but what did Joseph contribute? Certainly not his breeches, because they're on exhibition in Aachen. Once upon a time, many years ago, as time is calculated by men, but which was only yesterday in the celestial calendar of heaven, there was in paradise a most miserable, thoroughly unhappy, and utterly dejected cherub who is known throughout heaven as the littlest angel. He was exactly 4 years, 6 months, 7 days, 9 hours, 42 minutes, and 53 seconds old when he presented his small self before the venerable gatekeeper and waited admittance to the glorious kingdom of God. Standing defiantly with his bare brown legs spread wide apart, he tried to pretend that he wasn't at all afraid and not at all impressed by such unearthly splendor. But his lower lip trembled, and a tear disgraced him by making a new furrow down his already tear-streaked face and coming to a precipitous end at the very tip of his tiny freckled nose. And that wasn't all. The littlest angel, having left home with, as usual without a handkerchief, endeavored to hide the telltale evidence by sniffing, a most unangelic sound, which so unnerved the good gatekeeper that he did something he had never done before in all eternity. He blotted the page. Well, from that time on, the heavenly peace was never quite the same, and the littlest angel soon became the despair of all the heavenly hosts. His shrill, ear-splitting whistle could be heard at all hours through the golden streets. It startled the patriarch fathers and disturbed their meditation. Oh, and he was always arriving late for nightly prayers, knocking everyone's wings askew as he darted into place. And it was first whispered among the cherubims and seraphims, and then said aloud among the angels and the archangels that he didn't even look like an angel. And they were correct. He didn't. Because his halo was permanently tarnished where he'd held on to it with one hot, chubby hand while running, and he was always running. And even when he was standing still, it never behaved like a halo should. It was either slipping over the right eye, or slipping over the left eye, or else just for pure meanness slipping off the back of his head and rolling down some golden street just so he'd have to chase after it. And it must also be recorded that his wings were neither useful nor ornamental. All heaven would hold its breath when the littlest angel would perch himself on the very tip of a gilded cloud and prepare to take off. He would teeter this way and then that way, and after much coaxing and a few false starts, he would close his eyes and hold his tiny freckled nose, count up to 110, and then hurl himself slowly into space. However, owing to the regrettable fact that he always forgot to move his wings, he would always tumble head over Caleb. And it was also reported and never denied that when he was nervous, which was most of the time, he bit his wingtips. Well, anyone can see that soon or late the littlest angel would have to be disciplined. So on an eternal year of an eternal month in the year eternal, the littlest angel was directed to present his small self before the angel of the peace. He tried to postpone the dreaded ordeal as long as possible by loitering along the street of the guardian angel or stopping a few timeless moments to carefully examine a long list of new arrivals in heaven, although everyone up there knew he couldn't read a word. Or he stopped a little bit longer to carefully look over a new display of harps, although everyone in the heavenly kingdom knew that he didn't know a harp from a guitar. But at length and at last, he approached a door that was surmounted by two golden scales, signifying that heavenly justice was being dispensed within. The littlest angel combed his hair, dusted off his wings, breathed upon its almost tarnished halo, and kind of polished it on the sleeve of his robe, and then he tiptoed in. Well, to the great surprise of the littlest angel, he heard someone singing. So he immediately put his head down into the collar of his robe, very much like a snapping turtle. At that, the singer, who was known as the understanding angel, laughed. A jolly, heartwarming laugh, and he said, "Ho, ho! So you're the one who's been making heaven so unheavenly. Come here, cherub, and tell me all about it." Well, almost before he knew it, the littlest angel was perched on the lap of the understanding angel, trying to explain just how very difficult it was for a boy who suddenly found himself transformed into an angel. Oh, now don't misunderstand me. Not that heaven isn't beautiful, but oh, earth was so beautiful too. There were mountains to climb and caves to play at pirate chief and the moon and the sun and the stars and the warm sand so nice beneath your toes. And the understanding angel smiled, and in his eyes was a long-forgotten memory of another small boy long ago. And then he asked the littlest angel, "What would make you most happy in paradise?" Well, the littlest angel thought for a moment, and then he said, "Oh, I know. There's a box. I left it under my bed back home. Oh, if only I could have that box." "You shall have it," promised the understanding angel. And a fleet-winged heavenly messenger was instantly dispatched to bring the box to paradise. Well, in all those timeless days that followed, everyone remarked at the wonderful change in the littlest angel. For among all the cherubs in God's kingdom, he was the most heavenly. His conduct was above the slightest reproach, and his appearance was all that the most fastidious could wish for. And yes, on excursions to Elysian fields, it could be said, and truly said, that he flew like an angel. Well, then it came to pass that Jesus, the Son of God, was to be born of Mary in Bethlehem of Judea. And the angel and the archangel and the cherubims and the seraphims and the wingmaker and the gatekeeper and yes, even the halo smith put aside their usual tasks to prepare their gifts for the blessed infant. Everyone, that is, except the littlest angel. He perched himself on the very top of the golden stair, anxiously waited for inspiration. Oh, what could he give that would be appropriate as a gift for the Son of God? "I know. I'll write a prayer. A prayer that will live forever in the hearts of men because it will be the first prayer ever to be heard by the Christ child. It will go something like this. Dear God, Dear God, Amen? It really didn't have much literary ability at all. So then he said, oh, I know. I'll compose a hymn that the angels will sing when Jesus is born. And it'll go something like this. Alleluia. No. Alleluia. He really didn't have much musical ability either. Well, the day of the miracle finally approached when the littlest angel decided on his gift. And he took it from its hiding place behind the cloud. It was just a rough, brown, wood-hewn box. But inside were all those wonderful treasures that even the Son of God would love. And he put his box with very loving hands among the gifts of all the other angels. Gifts of such radiant splendor and glorious beauty that all heaven and the universe were lighted by the mere reflection of his glory. And suddenly the littlest angel realized that what he had done had been blasphemous. It had been irreverent to think that such a shabby box could ever be accepted by the Son of God. And all of a sudden, God's hand started moving over all the array of beautiful gifts that had paused and dropped and came to rest on the lowly gift of the littlest angel. And all heaven watched as God opened this box. And what was in the box? Well, there were two round stones that he had gotten from the riverbank one day when he had been playing. And there was a bright yellow butterfly that he had pressed, that he had captured one day in the sunny hills outside of Jerusalem. And there were two broken blue robin eggs. And there was a leather strap that had been worn by his mongrel dog who had died as he had lived in absolute love and infinite devotion. Well, there was a dreadful and ominous silence throughout heaven, unbroken except for the heartbroken sobbing of the littlest angel. And he turned to run and hide from the divine wrath of God, but he tripped and he stumbled and he rolled with a horrified wail and a clatter of halo to the very foot of the throne of God. And God's voice rose like thunder throughout the universe, and God said, of all the gifts of all the angels, I find that this gift pleases me most. For its contents are of heaven and of earth, and my Son is born to be king of both. I accept this gift in the name of the Christ child, who is to be born in this day in Bethlehem of Judea. And all of a sudden, the box began to shine. And as everyone watched, the shining box became a beautiful glow, and the gift began to rise from its place and begin to arch the firmament till it stood over a stable where the Christ child was born. And earthly eyes, too, blinded by its splendor, would never know that the lowly gift of the littlest angel was what all men would forever call the shining star of Bethlehem. This is a poem by Dorothy Sulla. She is a German theologian. She teaches at Union Theological Seminary. This one isn't for children, but it's not very long, so if you kids are here, maybe you can listen just a minute. It's called The Three Kings. I thought a lot about why they went. A major disturbance in the sky, a threefold source of light in an unexpected place, an unfamiliar star among familiar ones. Is that reason enough to set out on sand-drifted roads carrying stale water in leather bags, month after month, putting aside for now the question of higher powers that might have influenced them? I have no grasp of things that I would call what drove them from home where they must have had it good. I would call this revolutionary virtue of the modern era curiosity. This, I guess, is what spurred them on. They wanted to see what was up, to straighten out a new confusion, to account for this unexpected brightness and incorporate it in the existing order. So they built a powerful telescope. It didn't help. It didn't clear anything up. The new light just glowed more brightly than ever. So they chartered, well-to-do as they were, a fair-sized caravan to run down that star. So they bargained and bought, organized, laid in supplies, mapped out with thoroughness and foresight their route and watering places. They planned to travel at night so they could promptly modify their plan in accordance with the somewhat erratic course of the star. So they set out on their arduous way to explore this mysterious disturbance brought into the world by light. Were they able to explain this star? Did they go home curious of a higher order? Are they still underway, tracing irregularities in the heavens and on earth? Did they accommodate unexpected brightness to the everyday twilight about them? Or is there a chance that they accommodated themselves to amazing light? Could it be harnessed? If so, for what? Did they see clearer when they got there? More important still, did they who saw it change? Reports are few and evidence is scant, but assuming that they did change, I would praise the travelers and rejoice in them. And if this uncommon light is still shining, look at it long and often for their sake, hoping fervently for change. That's in a book called Revolutionary Patience. The last one I want to share with you. Even on Christmas. I suppose this is a familiar story to a lot of you. If you've been at Holden, it certainly is. Holden staff has probably heard it more often than they want to. It's my favorite Christmas story. It's a book called The Way of the Wolf by Martin Bell. He's an Episcopal clergyman who used to be a disc jockey. In every story, the Christ figure appears as a great gray silver wolf. It's called Barrington Bunny. Once upon a time, in a large forest, there lived a very funny bunny. He had one lop ear and a very tiny black nose and unusually shiny eyes, and his name was Barrington. Barrington was not really a very handsome bunny. He was brown and speckled, and his ears didn't stand up just right, but he could hop. And as I said, he was very furry. In a way, winter is fun for bunnies. After all, it gives them an opportunity to hop in the snow, and they turn around to see where they hopped. So, in a way, winter was fun for Barrington. But in another way, winter made Barrington sad. For you see, winter marked the time when all the animal families got together in their cozy homes to celebrate Christmas. He could hop, and he was very furry. But as far as Barrington knew, he was the only bunny in the forest. When Christmas Eve finally came, Barrington did not feel like going home all by himself. So he decided that he would hop around for a while in the clearing in the center of the forest. Hop, hop, hippity hop, Barrington made tracks in the fresh snow. Hop, hop, hippity hop, then he cocked his head and looked back at the wonderful design. Bunnies, he thought to himself, can hop, and they are very warm, too, because of how furry they are. But Barrington really didn't know whether this was true of all bunnies, since he had never met another bunny. When it got too dark to see the tracks he was making, Barrington made up his mind to go home. On his way, however, he passed a large oak tree, and high in the branches there was a great deal of excited chattering going on. Barrington looked up. It was a squirrel family. What marvelous time they seemed to be having. Hello up there! Hello down there, came the reply. Are you having a Christmas party? Yeah, it's Christmas Eve. Isn't everybody having a Christmas party? Can I come to your party? Asked Barrington softly. Are you a squirrel? No. Well, what are you then? I'm a bunny. A bunny? Yeah, I'm a bunny. How can you come to our party if you're a bunny? Bunnies can't climb trees. Well, that's true, said Barrington thoughtfully. But I can hop. I'm very furry and I'm warm. We're sorry, said the squirrels. We don't know anything about hopping and being furry, but we do know that in order to come to our house, she'd have to be able to climb a tree. Oh, well, said Barrington. Merry Christmas, anyway. Merry Christmas, chattered the squirrels. and the unfortunate bunny hopped off toward his tiny house. Well, it was beginning to snow when Barrington reached the river, and near the riverbank was a wonderfully constructed house of sticks and mud. Inside, there was singing. "It's the beavers," said Barrington. "Maybe they'll let me come to their party." So he knocked on the door.
"Who's out there?"
called a voice. "Barrington Bunny," he replied. There was a long pause, and then a shiny beaver broke through the water.
"Hello, Barrington,"
said the beaver. "Can I come to your Christmas party?" asked the bunny. The beaver thought for a while, and then he said,
"Well, I suppose so, but you know how to swim?"
"No," said Barrington, "but I can hop, and I'm furry, and I'm very warm."
"Sorry, I don't know anything about hopping and being furry, but I do know that in order for you to come to our house, you'd have to be able to learn how to swim."
"Oh, well," Barrington muttered, his eyes filling with tears. "I suppose that's true, but Merry Christmas anyway."
"Merry Christmas," called the beaver, and he disappeared beneath the surface of the water.
Even being furry as he was, Barrington was beginning to get cold. And the snow was falling so hard that his tiny bunny eyes could scarcely see what was ahead of him. He was almost home, however, when he heard the excited squeaking of field mice beneath the ground. "It's another party," thought Barrington. And suddenly he blurted out through his tears, "Hello, field mice, this is Barrington Bunny, and I'd sure like to come to your party." But the wind was howling so loudly, and Barrington was sobbing so much that no one even heard him. When there was no response at all, Barrington just sat down in the snow and began to cry with all his might.
"Bunnies aren't good to anyone. What good is it to be furry and to be able to hop if you don't have any family on Christmas Eve?"
Barrington cried and cried, and when he stopped crying, he began to bite his bunny's foot, and he didn't move from where he was sitting in the snow. Suddenly, Barrington was aware that he was not alone. And he looked up and strained his shiny eyes to see who was there. To his great surprise, he saw a huge silver wolf. The wolf was so large and strong, and his eyes flashed fire. He was the most beautiful animal that Barrington had ever seen. For a long time, the silver wolf didn't say anything at all. He just stood there and looked at Barrington with his terrible eyes blazing. Then slowly and deliberately, the wolf spoke. "Barrington, why are you just sitting here in the snow?"
"Because it's Christmas Eve and I don't have any families and bunnies aren't good to anyone."
"Bunnies are too good," said the wolf. "Bunnies can hop and they're very, very warm."
"Well, what good is that?"
"It's very good indeed. Because it is a gift that bunnies are given, a free gift with no strings attached. And every gift that is given to anyone is good for a reason. Someday you'll see why it's good that you can hop and you're warm and furry."
"But it's Christmas," moaned Barrington. "I'm alone and I don't have any family at all."
"Of course you have a family. All of the animals in the forest are your family." And the wolf disappeared. He simply wasn't there. Barrington had only blinked his eyes, and when he looked again, the wolf was gone. "All of the animals in the forest are my family," thought Barrington. "It's good to be a bunny, because bunnies can hop. That's a gift." And then he said it again, "A gift. A free gift. It's a gift. A free gift. It's a gift. A free gift." On into the night, Barrington worked. First, he found the best stick that he could, and this was very difficult because there was so much snow on the ground. Then hop, hop, hippity-hop to the beaver's house he went, and he left the stick outside the door with a note on it that read, "Here is a good stick for your house. It's a free gift. A gift. No strings attached. Signed, a member of your family." "Boy, it's a good thing I can hop," he thought, "because the snow is very deep. Bunnies are lucky they can hop." Then Barrington dug and dug, and soon he had gathered together enough dead leaves and grass to make the squirrel's nest warmer. Hop, hop, hippity-hop. He laid the grass and the leaves just under the large oak tree and attached the message, "A gift, a free gift from a member of your family." Well, it was late when Barrington started home, and what made things worse was that he knew a blizzard was beginning. Hop, hop, hippity-hop. Soon, poor Barrington was lost. The wind howled furiously, and it was very, very cold. "It certainly is cold," he said out loud. "It's a good thing I'm so furry, but if I don't find my home pretty soon, I might even freeze."
Squeak, squeak, squeak.
Then he saw it. A tiny baby field mouse lost in the snow, and the little mouse was crying. "Hello, little mouse," Barrington called. "Hello, little mouse. Don't cry, I'm coming to you." Hippity hop, Barrington was soon beside the tiny mouse.
"I'm lost," sobbed the little fellow. "I'll never find my way home. I think I'm going to freeze to death."
"You won't freeze," said Barrington. "I'm a bunny, and bunnies are furry and warm. You stay right where you are, and I'll cover you up." So Barrington lay on top of the little mouse and hugged him tightly to himself. The little fellow felt himself surrounded by warm fur. He cried for a while, but soon, snug and warm, he was sound asleep. Barrington had only two thoughts that long, cold night. First, he thought, "It's good to be a bunny. Bunnies are furry and warm." And then, when he felt the heart of a tiny mouse beneath him beating regularly, he thought, "All of the animals in the forest are my family." Next morning, the field mice found their little boy asleep in the snow, snug and warm, beneath the furry carcass of a dead bunny. Their relief and excitement was so great that they didn't even think to question where the bunny had come from. And as for the beavers and the squirrels, they still wonder which member of their family left the little gifts that Christmas Eve. After the field mice had left, Barrington's frozen body simply lay there in the snow. There was no sound except that of the howling wind. And no one anywhere in the forest noticed the great silver wolf who came to stand beside that brown, lop-eared carcass. But the wolf came, and he stood there, without moving and without saying a word, all Christmas Day until it was night. And then he disappeared into the forest.
I collect Christmas stories. And every year I try to read some new ones at Holden. That's not been true the past 2 years because I found several that I like more than anything else in the world. And so I'm choosing to read again this year The Best Christmas Pageant Ever. I will not bore you with the whole book. I have found a condensed version that I'm using, although the author who wrote the condensed version, Barbara Robinson, also wrote the book, but she left out some of my very favorite parts, so I'm adding those. So at a couple of points, I will go back to the book and pick up some of the very things that I thought were the most enjoyable about this story. It's called The Best Christmas Pageant Ever by Barbara Robinson. I'm out of it in the bookstore. The Herdmans were absolutely the worst kids in the history of the world. They lied, they stole, they smoked cigars, even the girls. They talked dirty. They hit little kids. They cussed their teacher. They took the name of the Lord in vain. And they set fire to Fred Schumacher's old tool house. Well, the tool house burned right down to the ground. And I think this surprised the Herdmans. Because they'd set fire to a lot of things. But this was the first time in the whole world that anything had absolutely burned down to the ground. Well, I guess it would have been different if they had burned down something like, let's say, the old Presbyterian church. But Mr. Schumacher's toolhouse, well, that was ready to fall down anyway, and it looked so awful, it was sure to bring wrath, that's what everyone said. And so actually, they said what the Herdmans did had been an absolute blessing in disguise. Well, my father actually said it was the best thing the Herdman kids ever did. But if they had known that they were doing something good in burning down the toolhouse, they probably never would have done it. They would have set fire to something else or to someone. They were just so all-around awful that you could hardly believe they were real. Ralph, Imogene, Leroy, Claude, Ollie, and Gladys. Six skinny, stringy-haired kids, all alike, except for being different in size and having different black and blue places wherever they had conked one another. They lived over a garage at the bottom of Sproul Hill. garage wasn't used anymore, and actually the Herdmans used it as a great game. They would take the garage door up and down as fast as they could and see who they could squash under it. That was their idea of fun. Where other people had grass in their front yard, the Herdmans had rocks. And where other people had hydrangeas, the Herdmans had poison ivy. There was also a sign in the front yard that said, "Beware of the cat." Well, everybody laughed at the sign until they actually got a look at the cat. It was the meanest looking animal I ever saw in my life. It had one short leg and a broken tail and a missing eye, and the mailman refused to deliver anything to the Herdmans because of the horrible cat. Well, they moved from grade to grade through the Woodrow Wilson School like those South American fish that strip your bones clean in 3 minutes. Which was actually what they did to one teacher after the other. But they never, never, never got kept back in a grade. When it came time for Claude Herdman to pass the second grade, he didn't know his ABCs or his numbers or his colors or his shapes or anything about the three bears or how to get along with anybody, but Miss Brandel just moved him ahead anyway. For one thing, she knew she'd have Ollie Herdman the next year. Well, the same thing was true about the Herdmans. There was always one coming after the other, and no teacher was crazy enough to let herself have two of them in the class at the same time. Well, I was always in the same grade with Imogene Herdman, and what I did was try to stay out of her way. Now, it wasn't very easy to stay out of Imogene's way. You couldn't do it if you were really pretty or really ugly or really smart or really stupid or had anything usual about you like red hair or double joints. But if you were the sort of medium kid like me who kept your mouth shut when the teacher said, "Who can name all of the 50 states?" Then you had a pretty good chance of staying clear of Imogene. As far as we could tell, Imogene was like the rest of the Herdmans. She never learned anything except dirty words, and those she learned from her older brother, Ralph. Twice a year, you see, we had to go to the health room to get weighed and measured, and Imogene always managed to find out exactly what everybody weighed. Sometimes she would hang around waiting for the nurse, Miss Hemphill, to give her a Band-Aid, and sometimes she would sneak behind the curtain they kept behind a folding cot to stay there the whole time with one eye on the scales as the kids got on them. "Why are you still there, Imogene?" asked Miss Hemphill one day. "You may go back to your room." "Well, I think you'd better come and have a look at what Ollie's got." "Well, what does Ollie have?" "I don't know. Red spots all over." Well, Miss Hemphill looked at her. "Well, what did the doctor say?" "Ah, we don't have a doctor," Imogene began, scrunching her back up and down against the medicine cabinet. "Well, does Ollie have a fever? Is he in bed?" "Nah, he's in the first grade." "Right now? Why, he shouldn't be in school with red spots all over. It could be measles or chicken pox or any number of contagious things. Oh, what are we doing? What are you doing, Imogene?" "Scratching my back," Imogene said. "Boy, I just itch all over." "Well, now the rest of you boys and girls go back to your room right away," Miss Hemphill said. "And Imogene, you stay right here." So we all went back to our room, and Miss Hemphill went to the first grade to look at Ollie, and Imogene stayed in the health room, copied down everybody's weight from Miss Hemphill's records. Now, your weight was supposed to be a big secret, like your report card. "It's nobody's business what anybody gets on your report card," all the teachers said. And the nurse said the same thing. "It's absolutely nobody's business what anyone weighs." Well, not even the fat kids could find out what they weighed, but Imogene always seemed to know. "Don't let Alfred Pelfrey on the swing," she would yell at recess. "He'll bust it. Alfred Pelfrey weighs 143 pounds, and last time he weighed 137. So right there, you knew two things about Albert. We knew exactly how fat he was, and we also knew that he was getting fatter all the time. "You're going to have to go to fat camp this summer," Imogene yelled at him. "Miss Hemphill wrote it down on your record." Well, fat camp is a place where they feed you lettuce and grapefruit and cottage cheese and eggs for a month, and either you give up and cheat or you give up and get skinny. "I am not going to fat camp," Albert said. "I'm going to Disneyland with my Uncle Frank." "Ha ha, that's what you think," Imogene said. Well, Albert had to believe her. She was always right about things like that for a year. So for a year, he had fat camp to look forward instead of going to Disneyland. The Herdmans taught one another, and they always looked after themselves. Mrs. Herdman held two jobs, so she didn't have to stay home with the kids, and Mr. Herdman had disappeared on a train some years ago. Ralph looked after Imogene, Imogene looked after Leroy, Leroy looked after Claude, and so on down the line. The Herdmans were like most big families. The big ones taught the little ones, and the little ones finally ended up knowing everything. And proof of that was that the meanest Herdman of all was Gladys, the youngest. Now, we all figure that Gladys was headed straight for hell by way of the penitentiary until the Herdman kids got themselves mixed up with a church, with my mother, and with the Christmas pageant. Now, Mother didn't expect to have anything to do with the Christmas pageant except to make me and my little brother, Charlie, go. We had to be in it. We didn't want to. And we had to make my father go. He didn't want to go. Every year he said the same thing. I've seen the Christmas pageant. Oh, you haven't seen the Christmas pageant this year, Mother said. Charlie is a shepherd this year. Charlie was a shepherd last year. No, you go on. I'm just going to sit here in my bathrobe by the fire and relax. There's nothing different about this Christmas pageant. Well, there's something different this year, said my mother. What? Charlie's going to be wearing your bathrobe. So this year my father went to the Christmas pageant to see his bathrobe. Actually, he went every year, but it was always a struggle, and my mother said that her contribution to the Christmas pageant was getting my father there. But then she got stuck with the whole thing when Mrs. George Armstrong fell and broke her leg and couldn't direct the Christmas pageant, which she did every year as long as I can remember. Now, our Christmas pageant isn't what you'd call four-star entertainment. The script is standard, the inn, the shepherds, the star, the stable, and so were the costumes and so is the cast. Primary kids are always the angels, the intermediate kids are always the shepherds, the big boys are the wise men, and Elmer Hopkins, the minister's son, is always Joseph. And my friend Alice Wendelken, for as long as I can remember, has been Mary because she's so smart and so neat and so clean-looking, and most of all, she looks just downright holy. Well, all the rest of us are the angel choir, and we line up according to height. We're strictly a no-talent outfit, except for a girl named Alberta Bottles, who whistles. Last year, Alberta whistled, "What Child Is This?" for a change of pace, but nobody liked it very much, especially Mrs. Bottles, because Alberta put so much into the rendition that she ran out of air and passed out cold on the manger in the middle of the third verse. Well, aside from that, it's always the same Christmas story, and year after year, we're all shuffling around in our bathrobes and bedsheets and sharp wings. Of course, nobody ever thought about the Herdmans in connection with the Christmas pageant. Most of us spent all week in school being pounded and poked and pushed around by them, and we looked forward to Sunday truly as a day of rest. Then my little brother Charlie told Leroy Herdman that we got dessert in Sunday school, and sure enough, the very next week they were all there. All six Herdmans slouching into Sunday school, their eyes peeled, looking for cookies and refreshments. And they got there just in time to hear about the Christmas pageant. What's a pageant? Asked Imogene. It's a play, I told her. What's a play about? It's about Jesus. Ah, everything is here. I figured with that comment, Imogene really didn't care much about the pageant, but boy, was I wrong. Next Sunday after church, we all filed into the back seven pews along with two or three Sunday school teachers who were supposed to keep everybody quiet while we found out who was who in the Christmas pageant. Now, you little children in the primary classes will be our angels, Mother said. Won't you just love to do that? They all said yes. What else could they say? Now, you older boys and girls will be the shepherds and guests at the inn and members of the choir. And now we need Mary and Joseph and the three wise men and the angel of the Lord. They aren't all hard parts, but they're very important parts, Mother said. Now, we all know what kind of a person Mary was. She was quiet and gentle and kind, and the little girl who plays Mary should be just that kind of person. Well, I know that many of you would like to be Mary in our pageant, but of course we can have only one Mary, so I'm going to ask for volunteers, and then we'll decide together which little girl should get the part. Well, that was pretty safe to say, since the only person who ever raised her hand was Alice Wendelton. But Alice just sat there, chewing on a piece of her hair, slouched down, looking at the floor, and the only person who raised their hand was Imogene Herdman. Do you have a question, Imogene? Mother asked. I guess that was the only reason she could think of for Imogene raising her hand. No, said Imogene, I want to be Mary, and Ralph back here wants to be Joseph. Yeah, said Ralph. Well, Mother just stared at them. Well, we're sure that we want to give everyone a chance. Now, is there anyone else at all that would like to volunteer to be Joseph? Well, no one did. No one ever did. Elmer always got stuck with the role because he was a preacher's kid, but he never really wanted to. Well, all right, said Mother. I guess Ralph will be Joseph. Now, is there anyone else that would like to volunteer to be Mary? Mother looked around trying to catch somebody's eye. Anyone else? Janet? Roberta? Alice, don't you want to volunteer this year? No, said Alice, but it was so low we could hardly hear. I don't want to. Well, nobody volunteered to be the wise men either, except Leroy, Claude, and Ollie Herdman. So there was my mother, stuck with the whole Herdmans in the main roles of the Christmas pageant. Well, there was one Herdman left over, and the one main role figure was the angel of the Lord that announced the good news to the shepherds, and we didn't have to guess very long to know who was going to have that part. Right away, all the shepherds began to wiggle around in their seats, figuring out that any news Gladys would bring them would come as a smack in the teeth. And they were right. You could just picture Gladys coming in and whamming all the shepherds around. While they were leaving, Mother grabbed Alice Wendelcombe by the arm and said, Alice, why in the world didn't you raise your hand to be Mary? I don't know, Alice said, looking really mad. But I knew. I had heard Imogene Herdman telling Alice what would happen to her if she dared to volunteer. Next spring, Imogene had whispered, when the piss pussy willows when the pussy willows come out, I'm gonna stick a pussy willow so far down your ear that no one will be able to reach it. And it'll sprout there, and it'll grow and grow, and the rest of your life, you're going to have a pussy willow bush sticking out of your ear. Well, that's why Imogene kept her mouth shut about wanting to be Mary. Oh, you know that. She wouldn't do that to you, I told Alice. Huh. Yes, she would, Alice said. The Herdmans would do anything. Your mother should have said no to them. Somebody should have put old Imogene out of the pageant, and all the rest of them, too. They're just going to do terrible things and ruin the whole pageant. Well, I thought she was probably right, and so did a lot of other people. And for 3 days, the phone kept ringing off the hook, and that was all the people in the church could talk about, was that the Herdmans had all the roles in the Christmas pageant. People said it wasn't fair for a whole family who didn't even come to church to barge in and take over the pageant. My father said somebody better lock up the ALCW silver service. My mother said she would rather be in the hospital with Mrs. Armstrong than be having to do this. Well, then the flower committee took a pot of geranium to Mrs. Armstrong and told her what was going on, and she nearly fell out of bed, traction and all. Oh, I feel personally responsible for all this, she said. Whatever happens, I accept the blame. Oh, if I had been up and around doing my duty, none of this ever would have happened. Oh, this could never have happened if I had been running the pageant. Well, that made my mother so mad she could hardly see straight. I have never seen her so mad. Up to now, she told my father, I've made up my mind that I would do the best under the circumstances. But now I'm going to make this the best Christmas pageant ever anybody ever saw, and I'm going to do it with the Herdmans, too. Well, the first rehearsal was about as much fun as a 3-hour ride on a school bus. About as noisy and crowded, too. This rehearsal, though, was kind of different. Everybody shut up and settled down right away for fear of missing something awful that the Herdmans might do. The Herdmans got there 10 minutes late, sliding into the room like a bunch of outlaws about ready to shoot up a saloon. Mother started to separate everyone into angels and shepherds and guests at the inn, but right away she ran into trouble. Who are the shepherds? Leroy wanted to know. Where do they come from? Ole didn't even know what a shepherd was. What's an inn? Claude asked. Well, it's like a motel, Mother told him, where people go and spend the night. What people? Well, different people. Well, Jesus? Oh, honestly, Alice Wendelken mumbled. Jesus wasn't even born yet. People like Mary and Joseph. Why? Ralph asked. What happened first? Imogene hollered. Why don't you start at the beginning? Well, this really scared me because in the beginning was very first part of the Bible, and I could just see us sitting there all night reading. The thing was, the Herdmans didn't know anything about Christmas. They knew that Christmas was Jesus' birthday, but everything else was new. The shepherds, the wise men, the star, the stable, the crowded inn. Mother said that she'd better begin by reading the Christmas story from the Bible. Well, this was a pain in the neck because most of us knew the whole thing backward and forward and never had to be told anything except where we were supposed to stand and what time we were supposed to be there for rehearsal. Now, there was Mary and Joseph, his espoused wife, being great with child. Pregnant! Yelled Ralph Herdman. Well, that stirred things up. All the big kids began to giggle, and the little kids wanted to know what pregnant was and why it was so funny. Mother had to hammer on the floor with the blackboard pointer. That's enough, Ralph, she said, and she went on with the story. I don't think it's nice to say Mary was pregnant, Alice Wendelken said to me. But she was pregnant, I pointed out. In a way, though, I agreed with her. It sounded so ordinary to say Mary was pregnant. Being great with child sounded much better. I'm not supposed to talk about people being pregnant, Alice said. She folded her hands very tightly in her lap and pinched her lips together. I think I'm going to tell my mother about this. Tell her what? Tell my mother that we're talking about things like this in church. My mother might not want me to be here. Well, I was pretty sure she'd tell her mother she wanted to be Mary, and she was just mad at my mother. I knew, too, that she would make it sound worse than it was, and Mrs. Wendelken would get madder and madder. Mrs. Wendelken didn't even like cats to have kittens or birds to lay eggs, and she wouldn't let Alice play with anybody that had two rabbits. There wasn't much I could do about it except pinch Alice, which I did, and she yelped, and Mother separated us and made me sit between Imogene Herdman and the others and sent Alice to sit in the middle of the baby angels. I wasn't crazy to sit next to Imogene. After all, I'd spent my whole life staying away from Imogene, but she didn't even seem to notice, not much. In fact, she just said, "Would you shut up? I want to hear what's going on." Well, among other things, I just couldn't believe this, because the Herdmans were never famous for being quiet or sitting still or paying attention to anything, the truant officers, teacher, parents, the police. And yet here they were, their eyes glued on my mother, drinking in every word. "What's that?" they would yell when they didn't understand the language. And when Mother read about there being no room in the inn, Imogene's jaw dropped. She sat up in her seat. "My God," she said, "they didn't even have room for Jesus." Well, I saw Alice purse her lips and suck in between her teeth. I knew this was something else Mrs. Wendelken would hear about, swearing in church. Well, now, Mother explained, nobody knew that the baby was going to turn out to be Jesus. Not even, well, you know, Mary, I'm sorry, nobody knew that the baby was going to turn out to be Jesus. "You said Mary knew," Ralph said. "Why didn't she tell them?" "I would have told them," Imogene put in. "Boy, would I have told them. What was the matter with Joseph that he didn't tell them? Her being pregnant and everything. And what was that thing they laid the baby in, Leroy? That manger? Is it like a bed? Why would they have a bed in the barn?" "Well, that's a very good point," Mother said. "They didn't have a bed in the barn, so Mary and Joseph had to use whatever there was." "Well, what would you do if you had a new baby with no bed to put the baby in?" "Yeah, we put Gladys in the bureau drawer," Imogene said. "There you have it," Mother said, blinking a little. "You didn't have a bed, so you had to use something else." Oh, we had a bed, Ralph said, only Ole was still in it and he wouldn't get out. He didn't like Gladys. He elbowed Ole. Remember how you didn't like Gladys? I thought that was pretty smart of Ole not to like Gladys right off the bat. Anyway, Mother said, Mary and Joseph used the manger, and that was a large feeding trough that they put the animals in. Now, what about those wadded up clothes, Claude wanted to know. The what? Well, you said she wrapped him in wadded up clothes. Swaddling clothes. Long ago, people used to wrap their babies very tightly in big pieces of material to make them cozy and comfortable. You mean they tied them up and put them in a feed box? Where in God's name was child welfare? Well, everybody knew that child welfare checked up on the herdmans every 5 minutes. And lo, the angel of the Lord came upon them, Mother went on, and the glory of the Lord shone round about them, and Shazam! Gladys yelled, flinging her arms out and smacking the kids next to her. What? Mother said. You see, Mother had never read Amazing Comics. Out of the black of night with a horrible vengeance, the mighty Marvel appears. Oh, I know what you're talking about, Gladys, Mother said. Well, this isn't exactly that, but it's something like, you see, the angel of the Lord comes to the shepherds in the field out of the black of night, Gladys said. Out of from nowhere? Right. Well, Mother looked unhappy. In a way, Gladys. So Gladys sat back looking very satisfied, as if that this was at least one part of the Christmas story that she understood. Now, when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, Mother went on reading, behold, there came wise men from the east to Jerusalem, saying, that's you, Leroy, Ralph said, and Claude and Ollie. So pay attention. What does it mean, wise men? Ollie wanted to know. Were they like school teachers? No, dumbbell, Claude said. It means something like the President of the United States. Well, that's very close, Claude said, Mother. Actually, they were kings. Well, it's about time, Imogene muttered disgustedly. Maybe they'll tell the innkeeper where to get off and get that baby out of that stupid barn. There they saw the young child with Mary, his mother, and fell down and worshipped him and presented him with gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Well, what's that stuff? Leroy wanted to know. Well, precious oils, Mother said, fragrant resins. Oils, hollered Imogene. What kind of cheapskate kings hands out oils? You get better presents from the firemen at Christmas. Well, then we got to King Herod, and the herdmans never had heard of him either, so Mother had to explain that it was Herod who sent the wise men to find baby Jesus and have him put to death. My God, said Imogene, he just got born and already they're out to kill him? Well, the herdmans wanted to know all about Herod, so I figured they liked him. He was so mean, he could have been their ancestor. I mean, can't you picture it? Herod Herdman? And who's going to be Herod in the play, they wanted to know. Well, we don't show Herod in this Christmas pageant, Mother said, and boy, did they get mad. They wanted somebody to be Herod so they could beat up on him. I can't understand the Herdmans. You would have thought that the Christmas story had come right out of the files of the FBI. They got so involved in it. Wanted to put a bloody end to Herod. Worried about Mary having her baby in a barn and calling the wise men a bunch of dirty spies. Well, they left the rehearsal arguing about whether Joseph should have set fire to the inn or just chased the innkeeper into the next town. We stumbled along the way right up to the last rehearsal, the day before the pageant. Now, this is going to be the big dress rehearsal, Mother told us. And right away, three or four baby angels began hollering because they had forgot to bring their wings, and half the angel choir had forgotten their robes. Now, don't worry about your robes and your wings, Mother said. The main thing of a dress rehearsal isn't the costume. The main thing is that we're going to go straight through it without stopping. Boy, was she wrong. The baby angels came in at the wrong place and had to go back out again, and a whole gang of shepherds didn't come in at all for fear of Imogene or of Gladys. Imogene couldn't find the baby Jesus doll wrapped up in her great big blanket, so she took a memorial urn, big flower thing, dropped it on Ralph's foot. Half the angel choir sang in Away in a Manger while the other half sang Oh Little Town of Bethlehem, so we had to start over a lot. I've got the baby here, Imogene barked at the wise men. Don't touch him, I am naming him Jesus. No, 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 Mother came flying down the aisle. Imogene, you're not supposed to say anything. Nobody says anything except the angel of the Lord. Mary and Joseph and the wise men are to just be a lovely picture for us to look at and to think about so we can understand what Christmas means. I guess Mother had to say things like that even though everybody knew it was a big lie. The Herdmans didn't look like anything out of the Bible. They looked more like trick-or-treat. Imogene had one of those great big gold earrings in her ear, and she refused to take it off. Now, Imogene, Mother said, you know Mary wouldn't wear a big earring like that. I have to wear these, Imogene said. Why is that? Well, I got my ears pierced, and if I don't keep something in them, they grow together. Well, they're not going to grow together in an hour or so, Mother said. What did the doctor say about leaving something in them? What doctor? Well, the doctor who pierced your ears. Doctor didn't pierce my ears. Well, who did? Gladys! Oh, that made you shudder. The thought of Gladys Herdman piercing ears. I thought she probably used an ice pick, and I kept watching Imogene all night to see if her ears were going to fall off. All right, Mother said, we'll try and find something a little bit smaller and more appropriate for you to wear in the pageant. Now, let's try to start from the beginning again and go straight through the whole thing. And, well, I think I ought to tell him what his name is, Imogene said. No, besides, you remember, it wasn't Mary who named the baby. I told you, Ralph said, and he whacked Imogene on the back. I named him. Now, Joseph didn't name the baby either, Mother said. God sent an angel to tell Mary what the baby would be named. Imogene sniffed. I would have named him Bill. What angel was that, Ralph wanted to know. Is that Gladys? No, Mother said. Gladys is the angel who comes to give the shepherds the good news. Yeah, Gladys said. Unto you a child is born, she yelled at the shepherds. Unto me, Imogene yelled back. Not them, it's me. I'm the one that had the baby. No, 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 Mother sat down in the front pew. This just means that, well, it means that Jesus belongs to everybody. Unto all of us a child is born. Now, please, let's start again. And this time, well, why didn't they let Mary name her own baby, Imogene demanded. What did the angel do? Just walk up and say, name him Jesus. Yes, yes, that's right, Mother said. Obviously, she was in a hurry to get finished and get away from the Herdmans. Well, by this time, everybody was hot and tired, and most of the baby angels said they had to go to the bathroom. So Mother said that we would take a 5-minute recess, and then we'll start over, she said, looking kind of hopeless, and go through it straight from the beginning without stopping. This never happened. We had a 15-minute recess, which is a big mistake, because Imogene spent the whole time in the ladies' room. Then Mrs. Homer McCarthy, who had come to church to drop off some cakes for the potluck supper, went into the ladies' room, opened the door, smelled something funny, saw smoke pouring out from the toilet stall, ran up to the church office and called the fire department. Well, we were singing, Angels We Have Heard on High, when we heard a fire engine pull up on the lawn of the church, the siren blaring, the red lights flashing. The firemen hurried in with their hoses, made us all go outside. They dragged the big hose in the front door and went looking for a fire to put out. The street was full of baby angels crying, and the shepherds started climbing all over the fire truck. The firemen and all the ladies of the potluck committee and the neighbors who came to see what was going on were there. Reverend Hopkins came running over from the parsonage in his pajamas and his bathrobe, and his wife never did forgive him for that. Nobody knew what happened, including the Herdmans, but I guess they figured out that whatever it was, they had done it, so they left. Well, the next day, Reverend Hopkins came to see my mother. I can't make head or tails of it, he said. Some people said those Herdmen set fire to the ladies' room, and some people say they set fire to the kitchen. They didn't set fire to anything at all, Mother said. Well, said Reverend Hopkins, looking unhappy, the whole church is in an uproar. Don't you think we should call off the pageant? Just because Imogene was smoking cigars in the ladies' room, Mother said, of course not. Well, this time she got madder too. This is going to be the best Christmas pageant ever. Well, you had to admire her. It was like General Custer saying, bring on the Indians. Well, maybe so, Reverend Hopkins said. I'm just afraid that no one was going to come to see it. Well, boy, was he wrong. Everybody came to see what horrible things the horrible Herdmans were going to do. On the night of the Christmas pageant, as we left for church, Mother said, I don't know what's going to happen. It may be the first Christmas pageant ever where Mary and Joseph and the wise men get in a fight and Mary runs away with the baby. She might be right, I thought, and I wondered what all of us in the angel choir ought to do in case that happened. It would be dumb for us just to stand there singing about the holy infant as Mary had run off with him. Well, at first nothing seemed very different. There was the usual mess all over the place. Baby angels getting poked in the eye by the other baby angels' wings. The grumpy shepherds stumbling over their bathrobes that were too long. And as usual, who was ever playing the piano pitched away in a manger so high that you couldn't hear it, let alone sing it. But everything settled down, and at 7:30 the curtain went up and the pageant began. While we sang Away in a Manger, the ushers lighted candles all around the church. It was beautiful. The spotlight came on as a star, so you really didn't have to know the words to Away in a Manger because you couldn't see anything anyway at this point. After we had sung two verses of O Little Town of Bethlehem, we were supposed to hum some more O Little Town of Bethlehem while Mary and Joseph came in a side door. Only they didn't come. So we hummed and we hummed and we hummed and we hummed. And we hummed, which is very boring and also very hard, because before long it doesn't sound like humming a song at all. It just sounds like a noisy old refrigerator. I guess we would have gone on humming until we all turned blue, but we didn't have to. Ralph and Imogene finally appeared, and for once they didn't come through the door pushing one another and yelling as they usually do. They opened the door and just stood there for a minute as if they weren't sure they were in the right place. I guess it was because of all the candles and the church being full of people, but they looked like those people that you used to see on the 6 o'clock news, like refugees as they stood waiting in some strange, ugly place with all their boxes and their things stacked around them. And it suddenly occurred to me that this must have been the way it was for the Holy Family, stuck away in a barn by people who didn't much care about what happened to them. They couldn't have been very neat and tidy either, but more like this Mary and Joseph. Imogene's veil was all cockeyed and Joseph's hair was all sticking out funny all over. Imogene had the baby doll, but she wasn't carrying it in her arm. She had it kind of flung over her shoulder. And before she put it in the manger, she burped it twice and then laid it down. Alice Wendelcombe gasped and poked me. I don't think it's very nice to burp the baby Jesus, she whispered, as if he had colic or something. I don't know why not, I said. He could have been fussy or hungry or burpy just like any other baby. After all, that's the whole point of Jesus. He didn't come down like a cloud or something like in Amazing Comics. Well, right away we had to sing, while shepherds watched their flocks by night, we had to sing really loud because there were so many shepherds, more than any other character, and they all had crooks and they were banging them around like hockey sticks. Well, next came Gladys from behind the angel choir, pushing people out of the way and stepping on everybody's feet. And since Gladys was the only one in the pageant who had anything to say, she made the most of you. Hey, everybody! Unto you a child is born! She hollered it as if it was the best news in all the world. And the shepherds trembled sore afraid. Of Gladys, anyway, but it looked good. Then there were three carols about the angels. It took a long time to get all the angels in because they were the primary kids and they all got nervous and cried and one kid wet their pants.
We got a little rest then while the boys all sang together, "We Three Kings of Orient Are," and everybody in the audience shifted around as they normally do to watch the three kings come down the aisle. Leroy Herdman was at the front, and he was carrying something very, very heavy. In fact, it was so heavy he almost dropped it. It was a ham, and right away I knew where it had come from. You see, my father was on a church charitable works committee, and they gave away food baskets at Christmas, and this was the Herdman's food basket ham. It still had a big ribbon wrapped around it that said, "Merry Christmas." Now, the Herdmans had never given away anything in their lives before except lumps on the head. So you really had to be impressed. Leroy dropped the ham in the front of the manger, and it looked so funny to see a ham there instead of those fancy bath salt jars that we always use for myrrh and frankincense. And then they went and sat down right next to the manger. While we sang, "What child is this?" the wise men were supposed to confer among themselves and then leave by a different way so everyone would understand that they were going home by a different route. But the Herdmans forgot, or they didn't want to, or something, because they didn't confer and they didn't leave. They just sat there looking at the baby, and there wasn't anything anybody could do about it. "They're ruining the whole thing," Alice Wendelken said, pursing her lips and sucking backwards through her teeth. "They're supposed to leave. It looks stupid for the wise men just to be sitting there." "Well, I don't know," I said. "They've come a long, long way. You wouldn't just to expect them to show up, lay down their ham, and leave, would you?" As for ruining the whole thing, it seemed to me that the Herdmans had improved the pageant a lot just by doing what came naturally, like burping the baby, for instance, or thinking that a ham would be a better present than a jar of bath salts. Well, usually by the time we got to Silent Night, which was the last carol, I was so fed up with the dumb Christmas pageant I could hardly wait for it to be over. But this time I didn't feel that way at all. I almost wished that the pageant would go on, and with the Herdmans in charge, it just seemed neat to see what was going to happen. Maybe the wise men would tell Mary about their problem with Herod, and she would tell them to go back and lie their heads off. Or Joseph might go with them and get rid of Herod once and for all. Or Joseph and Mary might ask the wise men to take the baby Jesus with them, figuring that no one would think to look where they were. Oh, I was so busy planning new ways to save the baby Jesus that I missed the beginning of Silent Night, but it was all right because everybody always sings Silent Night with the kids. By the time we got to "Son of God Loves Pure Light," I happened to look at Imogene, and I almost dropped my hymn book on the baby Jesus. Everybody had been waiting all this time for the Herdmans to do something absolutely unexpected. And sure enough, that was what happened. Imogene Herdman was crying. In the candlelight, her face was all shiny with tears, and she didn't even bother to wipe them away. She just sat there, awful old Imogene Herdman, in her crooked, funny veil, just crying. Well, it was the best Christmas pageant we ever had. Everybody said so, but nobody seemed to know why. And when it was over, people stood around talking instead of hurrying out, wondering what the difference was this year. They said it was something special, but they just couldn't put their finger on what it was. Alice's mother, Mrs. Wendelken, said, "Well, Mary, the mother of Jesus, had a black eye. That was something special, but only what you'd expect." She meant it was natural for Imogene Herdman to have a black eye, but actually nobody had hit Imogene. Her eye wasn't really black either. It was just all puffy and swollen. When she was getting ready to go on stage, she had walked into the corner of the choir robe cabin in kind of a daze, as if she had just caught on to the idea of God and of the wonder of Christmas. And this was the funny thing about it all. I'd never really understood about the wonder of Christmas and the mystery of Jesus' birth, but now, because of the Herdmans, it didn't seem so mysterious after all. When Imogene had asked me what the pageant was about, I told her it was about Jesus. But that was just part of it.
It was about a new baby and a mother and a father who were in a lot of trouble. They had no money, no place to go, no doctor, nobody they knew. And then arriving from the East, just like my uncle from New Jersey, there were some rich friends. But Imogen, I guess, just didn't see it that way. Christmas just came over her all at once, like a case of chills and fever. And so there she was, crying and walking around in a daze and walking into furniture. Well, afterwards, there was the orange and the nuts and the candy canes and the tiny testaments for everyone. We put away the costumes and folded up the collapsible manger. And just before we left, my father snuffed out the last of the tall white candles. "Well, I guess that's about everything," he said, and he stood back, looking at the church. "All over now. It was quite a pageant, honey." He looked at my mother. "What's that you've got back?" "It's the ham," she said. "They wouldn't take it. I tried to give it to them. They wouldn't take the candy either, or the nuts, or the oranges, or any of the little Bibles. But Imogen did ask me for a set of Bible story pictures, and she took out the picture of Mary and said it was exactly right, whatever that means. I think it meant that no matter how she herself was, Imogen liked the idea of the Mary in the picture, all pink and white and pure looking, as if she had never washed dishes or cooked supper or had done anything at all except have the baby Jesus.